The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly, like a big purple box of chocolates, it's got quality written all over it. Today, Champions League. After Chelsea's triumph at Old Trafford, will Bayern put another nail in Man United's season this Wednesday? Or can Wayne Rooney make a miracle return? And what of Barcelona-Arsenal? The Gunners' chances look extra slim. But after a week that's seen Ricky Martin come out as gay, who'd rule out even the biggest of surprises? Speaking of happy bent men, back in the Premier League meanwhile, does Sunderland's big win over Spurs mean the start of a late season slump for Tottenham? Did Liverpool's top four run end at St Andrews? And what of West Ham, with owner David Sullivan tired of staring the bottom in the face, although he's built a career on that, the Hammers pull a performance off the top shelf, as it were, at Goodison. We round up the latest news from all over Europe, plus your posts and much, much more in today's Football Weekly. It's a big and special bank holiday hello to you, listeners, and Barry Glendening.
Hello.
James Dart.
Hello, James.
And John Ashdown.
Hi.
Here in the Football Weekly pod. So much as ever to discuss. We've got to begin, though, with a big game at Old Trafford on Saturday afternoon. 2-1 victory for Chelsea. Decisive, Barry. What did you learn from the experience?
Well, obviously it was decisive, but... Because it means Chelsea got 2 points ahead of United with not that many games left to go. Five, is it? And get blank stares all around.
Might be five.
Might be five. Right. Five or six or seven.
All right.
A few.
Was it all Berbatov's fault? Because he's been fingered, if you'd excuse the expression, for the defeat, for not being Wayne Rooney up front, basically.
Well, yeah, like the same way Lucas gets fingered for not being Alonso in midfield for Liverpool. I don't think it was all Berbatov's fault, but he certainly didn't play well. And I think a lot of people were hoping he would be able to step into young Wayne's size nines, and he didn't do that. He's lazy, he doesn't run. His, you know, notoriously good touch sort of deserted him for the afternoon. And I think he had four shots on goal, three of them off target, and one a pretty poor volley that he probably should have scored with, but didn't.
Yeah.
It was also a game, there was some strange refereeing decisions in it. Mike Dean...
Did they balance each other out,
I think they did, yeah. So Ferguson was complaining about the referee afterwards, but, you know, he should have given two penalties and didn't, probably because a lot of media attention was focused on him before the game for the huge number of penalties he gives. I wrote an article for the paper on a Saturday, all my fault that no penalties were given.
You were in the paper?
Yeah.
Oh, nice one. On Mike Dean.
Don't patronise me.
James?
No, I was going to say, I mean, I think as well as Berbatov getting the blame, I think you could, in all fairness, say that Sir Alex Ferguson should get, in this way, fingered. He didn't... I don't want to put that image in your mind, but he...
too late now.
Sorry. I can't really remember the last time I've seen United come out into a game so flat into that game. And you could say, I mean, look at what he has to offer up front. I mean, Berbatov was his only real option yesterday, at the weekend, sorry. And he signed an injury-prone Michael Owen. Yeah. Where's that now? He could have signed Carlos Tevez. Nah, didn't really work out either. And so he's left with the real bare bones. And
because Tevez, that kind of scurrying, chance-creating attacker is exactly the sort of chat they could have done with.
I think it's because the comparisons between the likes of Rooney and Berbatov, what they would have offered on Saturday's performance have been covered already. But Berbatov, yeah, it's far too languid and lazy.
The fact of having your backup striker is so completely different to your first choice striker creates problems, because it means that when your first choice striker is out, you've got to learn to play very quickly in an entirely different way.
Yeah.
And the ball's going up to the front man. I've got to be of a different ilk.
So is there really nobody else who he could have used up front?
I've heard United fans sort of espousing the value of playing perhaps Makeda on Wednesday night.
Uh-huh.
But I'm almost certain if Rooney does make a surprise recovery, you know, he'll play. And if not, it will be Berbatov again.
It would be a big surprise, because they were originally talking about sort of 2 weeks to a month out for Wayne, but now 40% is the latest I've heard his chances
a returning four, this immense game against...
Yes, I mean, it could well be Ferguson trying to get in the head of Bayern again, trying to just unsettle their preparations for the game. Not that I think they'll be particularly unsettled going into the game as it is. But again, I mean, and going back to Ferguson, the smokescreen of complaining about the officials. I mean, of course, the officials were incredibly poor in that game, but had no relevance on the outcome of the game for me. I think that there were enough opportunities that were cancelled out for Chelsea as well. And it takes away from Chelsea that they were very impressive.
Indeed they were. Well, Chelsea then, what can stop them now? John Ashton. No, you can. Not that I'm saying
me.
You can stop.
What am I supposed to do?
What do you think they could? You know, where could they come on?
What could foil them? Well, they've got two tricky away trips to Spurs and Liverpool coming up.
Although, are those tricky trips?
Well, they're inconsistent, aren't they? You can see what sort of Arsenal and Man United will be hoping is that they've got to win all their games and that Chelsea drop points, and that doesn't necessarily mean losing games. That could be two draws at White Hart Lane and Anfield could be the difference. That's not to say that I think that'll happen.
Mm. Although there is a suggestion that, you know, Mourinho has once again won Chelsea the title by you know, ironically, knocking them out of European competition. You were impressed with them, though, James.
I think we touched upon it last week about Florent Malouda's improvement. He's looking much more confident. He's looking like the player that Chelsea really wanted to splash out and spent big money on him from Lyon when they signed him originally.
Joe Cole as well.
Joe Cole coming back into it. I mean, still, I mean, there have been a lot of question marks over his future in the past months. But if they can get him back fully fit ahead of the World Cup, I mean, it's good news for England, but it's also very good news for Chelsea.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And Bayern Munich, Barry?
Well, they won on...
Yeah, similar
Saturday.
Kind of clash, wasn't it?
It was top v second. Schalke were top and Bayern were second, but now Bayern have gone ahead of them. They won 2-1.
Despite playing with just 10 men for much of the match.
Yeah, Alton and Top was sent off in the 41st minute.
Uh-huh.
You didn't think I'd know that, but I do. Ha. But what's his name, Dutch man?
I'm not helping you.
Yeah.
Louis van Gaal.
No. Arjen Robben, sorry.
Not him.
Arjen Robben didn't play, but will almost certainly be fit for...
That's good to know.
Oh, I've got a good Bayern stat if you want to hear it. Bayern haven't failed to score in a game since losing to Bordeaux on the 3rd of November. So their scoring record is excellent, and they've scored in every away game in the Champions League this season.
Right. Good. Now, I mentioned Tevez, and he, of course, was getting busy at Burnley on Saturday. What has Brian Laws done? This team was invincible at home.
It's like when Michael Flatley went from Lord of the Dance and then did his Feet of Flames. He took a concept that was already bad and made it considerably worse.
Right.
Which is kind of like what Brian Laws has done at Burnley.
Right.
He's quite clearly not cut out for the job. I don't know why they gave it to him in the first place. Well, I do know why. It was because of this Deloitte study they had done. And Deloitte decided that Brian Laws per pound spent was the most successful manager in the Championship when he was at Sheffield Wednesday. I think Sheffield Wednesday fans would probably disagree quite emphatically. But he seems to be way out of his depth at Burnley, particularly on Saturday afternoon when he was nearly under 12 feet of water.
Ah.
But if Burnley had been slightly luckier, they could possibly have had the game abandoned in the second half. Such was the deluge. But they were 3-0 down after 6 minutes, and a lot of their fans left after 6 minutes.
What do you regard as the ethics of walking out on your team after 6 minutes?
Well, I remember a couple of years ago when Sunderland were doing particularly badly under Mick McCarthy. Not really through any fault of his own, because he had no money to spend, but seeing some Sunderland fans interviewed on Sky Sports News, and they said that the only reason they went to the games was so that they could leave early. And they reckoned that that was a better protest than not actually turning up at all.
Well, we were saying, I mean, there's no point doing the old ripping up your season ticket in front of Brian Laws now, because there aren't that many games left. Ultimately... they are making a point, and it's more protesting at Brian Laws, I think, rather than the team themselves. I think a lot of Burnley fans have really turned against him, and rightly so. I mean, he's turned in an abject display. I did have to laugh at the fan who punched his hand on the wall, or the roof, sorry, as he walked out, which he's probably got his right hand in a cast at this very moment, which is quite amusing. In terms of walking out after that minute, I don't know. Teams have turned it around before. You should probably stick behind them. And the fans that stayed behind did get behind the team fantastically well. Ultimately, though, it should have been double figures, and it's one of those games where you almost wish that City don't take their foot off the gas and really go and really humiliate them. Although, as you said about the condition of the pitch, early this season when Barnsley were winning 4-1 at Plymouth, the pitch was no worse. and they called the game off.
Who won the replay?
It was 0-0 last week. Oh. So I think Plymouth will claim the moral victory on that one. But Barnsley fans, yeah, will be pretty irate at that because the pitch wasn't good at the Turf Moor.
No. they're playing Hull next, Burnley. We'll talk more about Hull perhaps next. Barry, you had a treble, which involved, I know the listeners are always excited to keep up with our betting activity. You had a treble which involved, am I right to say this, Burnley?
I did a treble, a 20 quid treble on Saturday. It was
Sunderland were in there as well,
Sunderland,
weren't they?
Sunderland, Arsenal, who gave me a scare.
Sunderland must have given you a scare as well, because that was a crazy game.
Well, you see, the thing is, I was actually out with Mrs. Baz, and she brought me to Vinopolis, the wine place, for a tasting.
Two thumbs up from James Dart. The London-based tour. Listeners, if you're in the Waterloo area and you fancy a glass of... Well, what kind of thing do? Do you drink wine?
You get shown how to taste wine properly, which when you've got like about 40 people all doing it at the same time, it sounds like a very bad porn movie.
Right, and kazoos and that.
Oh, and we had a celebrity in our midst because Rob Brydon was there, Welsh actor / comedian, as part of a stag do. So then you go and you get to taste like about five or six different wines, or as many as you want, really. But I think five is the set menu, and then you get a couple of glasses of rum and a gin, a Bombay Sapphire cocktail. So you're pretty steaming by the time you leave.
A wine tasting menu is called a flight.
All right, I didn't know that.
Well, they didn't think to inform you of that.
Anyway, sorry, I digress.
That story.
Sorry.
That's your alphabet day in sorted for V.
Sorry, I digress. Anyway, so I was trying to surreptitiously keep up with events at Turf Moor on my mobile. And even when City were 3-0 up, I was still slightly worried that, you know, if any team could sack it up for me, they would do it, but they held on.
I can tell you it was indeed a vintage performance. A terrific game.
A lot of sour grapes on the part of Burnley fans.
And
Jack Cork didn't play very well, did he?
Is he a player for one of those two teams?
Burnley player. Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah.
We were on Sunderland Spurs. Oh, but
bollocks.
But I'm afraid in the end that Darren Bent almost bottled it from the spot. Oh, goodness me. No. But it was a terrific game, and lots of penalties, missed penalties, great saves by Gomez, less good saves by Gomez, but vindication, if you will, for Darren Bent, you know.
Well, he was obviously very pleased when he opened the scoring. He had a dream star to open the scoring after a minute. Very enthusiastic celebrations, and then when he scored the second half. I think the two penalty misses were probably... tempered his performance, and you'd be a bit disappointed with that.
Hammer Raccoon says, I'm confused. Is scoring two goals and missing two penalties vindication for Darren Bent or Harry Redknapp? My missus could have scored those penalties. Not sure that's fair, actually, because they're very good saves, weren't they?
I think so. I mean, I think also at the moment, for me, I mean, in terms of looking at England in the World Cup, the fact that, I mean, could you really put Colton Cole ahead of Darren Bent right now? I think it's quite tough.
Certainly not in the dictionary. And does the Spurs collapse start here? They have Chelsea, Man United, Arsenal and Man City to play, as well as, of course, the FA Cup semi-final against Battlin Pompey. What do you think, John?
Got a lot of injuries as well, haven't they? Which is going to be a bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's necessarily going to be a case this season of a team imploding to throw fourth away. Mm. I simply think Man City will win more points over the remaining games of the season. I don't necessarily think that Spurs have to, you know, choke or disintegrate in any way. It just not being quite good enough would be enough.
Mm. All right. Very good. Well, we haven't talked about Arsenal yet. And, of course, following their magnificent 1-0 victory over Wolves on the weekend, they're going to be taking on Barcelona in the new camp. We're going to get Sid on the line as we discuss that after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian in association with SportingBet.com.
Once turned out for Yeovil.
He did, yeah. And Scunthorpe.
He turned out for Scunthorpe?
He did.
What's he doing? Oh!
Ian Botham's the answer to one of the quiz questions. Three players who play for England and play for Scunthorpe, and it's Ray Clements, Kevin Keegan and Ian Botham. You see?
There you go. That is Sid Lowe, ladies and gentlemen. We were just discussing Scunthorpe and Ian Botham because we were also talking about Yeovil, who are currently playing Leeds. We might be turning our attention to a little bit later on, an ongoing implosion in the League One promotion race. Right now, though, The arrival of Sid Lowe on the line means it's time to talk Liga. And first off, Sid, that Barcelona-Arsenal game coming up. Now, I was making a list of reasons. Here we are. A list of reasons that Arsenal might have a chance, actually, in this game. Do you want to hear them?
Go on, then.
All right.
First of all, by the way, am I childish? Am I childish in finding the name Scunthorpe very funny?
Why is it funny, Sid?
You could underline four of the letters in the word, couldn't you? And it's very amusing. But as I said, I'm childish.
Well, yeah. We have to call them Firewall FC in the Fiverr because the Fiverr doesn't get into a lot of email inboxes if the word Scunthorpe is in it. For that very reason.
I was once told a crossword clue for Scunthorpe, and it was a Yorkshire town with a twat in the centre. The only thing is, I'm not sure it's strictly speaking in Yorkshire anymore, is it? I don't know.
Why?
Isn't Scunthorpe... I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, no, but didn't they redraw the boundaries up that part of the world?
Back to my list of points about Arsenal, though, in this game, which Alan84 has imaginatively dubbed Barcelona after last week's Barcelona, you see. Okay, first off, no Piqué and Puyol, yeah? Mm-hmm. So no first-choice centre-backs for Barcelona. Now, Ibrahimovic went off, and that was coincidental, at least, with Arsenal coming back into the game last week, and he's out, I believe, with a muscle tear, is he, this time around?
Yeah, muscle tear of half a centimetre, which they think means that there's a hope, at least, of him being back against Real Madrid at the weekend for Clasico, which, of course, is the game that's kind of occupying people's minds almost as much as this Arsenal
game. Well, that's point three. Barcelona are distracted by the Clasico coming up this weekend, and then Barcelona complacent after their stirring first half, which actually only got them a draw, but it felt almost as if they'd kind of settled the question beyond doubt because they're just so much better than Arsenal, and possibly distracted, as you say, by the Clasico, while Arsenal may have learnt their lesson after giving Barcelona all that room to play and then, you know, tightening up on them in the second half with greater effect. Plus, get this one, I think we're on point 16 now, Barcelona haven't won any of their last five home games against English teams. What's this? What's this, Sid Lowe?
What is it, indeed? But yeah. they've gone through, obviously, against Chelsea, so I suppose it's not too much of a problem. Right, let's try and take those one by one.
Well, I haven't finished yet.
Is there more?
Point 73, Walcott.
Is there a subsection to this?
No, that's enough.
Point 15,
that's enough points.
Subsection A.
Right, that's enough points. You deal with those first, and then we'll see what else I've got.
Okay, well, let's start with Ibrahimovic. Yeah. Ibrahimovic didn't play against Stuttgart, and Barcelona produced a brilliant performance. He didn't play against Athletic Bilbao the weekend, as you say, because he went off with this half-centimetre tear in his thigh. He actually went off during the warm-up. We were expecting him to start, and he didn't. Now, that's obviously a problem for Barcelona, not least because it gives them an outlook, but I think they can play well without him, in particular in a game in which the key is keeping the ball rather than necessarily scoring lots of goals.
How did they do without him at the weekend, Sid?
Well, they won 4-1 against Athletic Bilbao, and the guy who came in to replace him was Bojan, and Bojan scored twice and played very, very well indeed. In fact, I'm starting to really like him. I must say, the last couple of years, even when he was scoring goals, I was never quite convinced by him. But I think he looks faster and stronger and more convinced by what he's doing this season on the very rare occasions that he's played than has happened in the past. So I think that's maybe not a huge problem, although, of course, it is problematic for them. At the back, this is interesting, and I think what they'll do is they'll go for Gabi Milito alongside Rafa Márquez. And quite honestly, Rafa Márquez is not good enough anymore, fundamentally because he's not quick enough. And I think that's quite significant because of the pace of Theo Walcott, because of the fact that while Barcelona could go through with a 0-0 draw or even with a 1-1 draw, it's not really in their nature to play like that. They do play very high, and that does offer the opportunity of a relatively simple ball over the top for someone to run, particularly someone like Walcott, who would be a lot quicker than Rafa Márquez. In that sense, I think the return to the side, the return to fitness at last of Eric Abidal is very significant because he's one of the few genuinely fast players at the back alongside Carlos Puyol. So yeah, that could genuinely be a problem. But I think the key will be how well Barcelona keep the ball and whether or not they're able to, and whether Arsenal are able to prevent them from doing that, which of course Song tried to do in the first leg by sort of deciding, hang on, we're not getting anywhere here, why don't I start kicking people?
Indeed. In the press, in the Catalan press, Sid, are there any big concerns about this game? Walcott or perhaps the spectre Nicholas Bentner sending shivers down Catalan spines?
Well, it's Walcott they're talking about the most because he made such a difference in the first leg, because Barcelona have talked a lot about the significance of his speed and the fact that he can outrun people. But Abidal said something very interesting yesterday. He was saying, yeah, but it's not just about running. That would be athletics. It's about being able to do something with the ball. Now, obviously, an Arsenal fan would gladly remind him, hang on, when he got the ball, he did score Theo Walcott in the first leg. But I suppose Abidal's got a point.
I do think Barcelona are vulnerable to a ball through the gap or over the top, and I think that's significant. As you say, the sense of whether this game matters, yes, it does, but it's been bundled in together with the Clásico, and the talk, not just about this match, it's about a week which will define Barcelona's season. Of course, it will define Barca's season until the next week that does. If they were to go through, then the semi-finals would define their season. But the fact that the Clásico is coming up against Real Madrid that weekend means that it's not just about this, and there is a feeling that Barca have a very, very good advantage, which, of course, they do, because 2-2 away, Arsenal is brilliant. Nowhere near as brilliant as the report should have been, but it is a significant position for them to be in. There is a risk of complacency, or at least there would be if it was any other club, but I think Pep Guardiola has been very, very good at not allowing players to fall into those kind of traps.
Right. OK, well, certainly their record at home has been so impressive, not necessarily against English clubs, but when you think, and we mentioned this last time, the way they struggled away to Stuttgart, but absolutely destroyed them at home, and last season when it looked like Bayern might have a chance of putting them out, and then it got absolutely torn apart.
Absolutely destroyed Inter as well at the Camp Nou this year.
Yeah,
really
they did,
destroyed
they?
Them. Who they about Ibrahimovic as well, I think, if I remember rightly.
I believe you're correct.
Sure I do.
No, I think you're right. They might be meeting again in the semi-final. In the league, as you say, Barcelona won and Real won with a 2-0 victory at Santander. And the Clásico looms. Unless, of course, Sid, there's a strike.
Yeah, I suspect there won't be, but there is still the possibility. And of course, if you're going to be, as the players' union is right now, trying to flex your muscles and going to be trying to make a case yourself, and the best way of doing it is say we will strike the week of the Clásico. Let's see how you like them eggs. I think it's something like €12 million worth of unpaid salaries that the players' union is claiming. They're also owed €6.9 million by the Spanish Football Association, and they're saying, well, if this isn't sorted out, because there's a new man in charge, a guy called Rubiales, who's the new president of the association, if this doesn't get sorted out, we will go on strike. Now, I don't think it'll happen, but I actually think it would be very, very good if it did, because the financial situation is very bad, and it does need something of a wake-up call.
Apples, Sid.
Apples, did I say?
You said eggs. I mean, Easter and all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In other Champions League news, two French sides clashing. Interesting. Bordeaux, who are 3-1 down from the first leg against Lyon. But they've got that perfect record. They've won 4 out of 4 at the Stade Chaban Delmas, or something to that effect, in this season's UEFA Champions League. Also, Lisandro, who was so effective for Lyon in the first leg, is suspended, along with Sidney Govou. So there you go.
History, however, is against Bordeaux.
Is it?
Because no side has overcome a two-goal deficit in the Champions League for 6 years in a knockout match, and only once in the last 3 years has a side recovered after losing the first leg of a knockout match in the Champions League.
Really?
Yeah. Don't ask me who, because I don't know.
No, but I'm just amazed that it happens so infrequently. You'd have thought that...
I picked up that nugget on the UEFA website, so
did
I
you?
Assume it's correct.
Well, you'd hope so. There you go. The other Champions League, of course, quarterfinal this week is Inter at CSKA Moscow. And a lot of talk about the plastic pitch that CSKA have at the Luzhniki Stadium. Does it really make such a difference, John? Man United have gone and won there. When was it? September, October in the Champions League this year?
Yeah, it was in the autumn sometime, wasn't
it? Yeah.
It was the pitch that England came unstuck on ahead of against Russia in qualifying, wasn't it?
It was.
It's always why. I think it must. It has to be an advantage, doesn't it? It has to be to make a difference to play on a plastic pitch. Otherwise, why would you have one? But, you know, it was always, you know, QPR and Luton back in the 80s when they had theirs. It was
different calibre of pitch, though.
Oh, yeah.
Theirs was more sort of a Subutio mat rather than a... This one has actual grass,
fake
inverted
grass,
commas.
Yes.
The CSKA or CSKA manager, Leonid Slutsky, insists that it doesn't give his team an advantage, but I don't see how it couldn't, because they're obviously more used to playing on it than people who don't play on it every second
week. But if you play kind of tippy-tappy football, if you like to pass the ball around and keep it on the ground, then presumably it's the kind of surface that you like rather than having to deal with some kind of waterlogged or churned up bit of turf somewhere in some far-flung corner of Europe. And I think
what might be of more advantage to CSKA is that they've had a rest over the weekend because their match against Zenit was postponed because of the terrorist attacks in Moscow last week.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, that's a big game for Inter, who have a 1-0 lead from the San Siro leg. Inter coming into this one fresh from a victory over the weekend against Bologna, which saw Balotelli back in the side. He said sorry, not for doing anything, but sorry about the situation. And he came back in the side and set one goal up, scored another, had another one disallowed. Tum-ti-tum-ti-tum-ti-tum. So Inter remain top spot. Roma, big win for them away to Bari, not an easy place to win. Totti back in the side, they had a victory there. And Milan, a very spirited performance at the Sant'Elia Stadium in Sardinia, a 3-2 win against Cagliari, who are having a rotten run of late, and that keeps them in the mix as well. There is another story that's a brewing in Syria. John Ira posting in saying, I've heard the Calciopoli scandal is perhaps making a reappearance, and it's true. Because everybody's favourite football corruption story has been back in the news. There was all the sporting verdicts back, you know, following the 2005-2006 season, which saw Juve go down, Lazio penalised, Fiorentina penalised, Milan penalised. But then the police came in and they said, well, this is actually a criminal act that's gone on here. There's been conspiracy and attempted a fraud, etc. And there's been a criminal trial going on down in Naples, which has seen Antonio Giraudo, the former Juventus director general, get a 3-year sentence for being very, very naughty. And Luciano Moggi, who was seen as the Mr. Big behind it all, let's face it, he was. He's currently on trial. Now, his lawyers have pulled off something of a coup by uncovering transcripts of Inter directors talking to the people who ran the referees. Now, the thing was until now, and the reason why Inter picked up one or two titles by default, was that they had recordings of Juve doing this and Fiorentina applying for favours and Lazio too, and some suspicious contacts between a bloke at Milan, who Milan disavowed but to no avail, and referees. But there weren't any recordings of the Inter people doing this. And lo and behold, Moggi's lawyers have now uncovered some sort of recordings, which seem to say, the ones we've seen so far, seem to show a similar calibre of contact between the man who basically assigned referees to matches and the directors at Inter. This, to an extent, backs up Moggi's theory that he was just one of many and that Inter were not the innocent victims of it all. He was still up to no good, but possibly Inter were too. But I think we need to wait until Tuesday when the next batch of transcripts is due to hit the public domain, and then we can see if there really is anything about this or if they're just desperately trying to throw some mud at somebody else and make out that they were just one of many, as opposed to being the dark, evil masterminds behind a really shadowy empire of corruption.
James, is there any way that Inter's title or one of the titles could be taken away from
them? Why not? They took away Juve's. Christian Vieri, on a side note, would like to see Inter's title taken away for the, is it the 2005? Yeah, it's the 2005-2006 season, the one they rewarded. Juve won it on points and it was given to Inter after the Calciopoli scandal because they were paying private investigators to follow him and they were tapping his phone. And he says that this breaches all sorts of sporting guidelines, and as a result, they deserve a sporting penalty, points taken away from them. So please, should they be made to give their title back? And he's taken them to court, the kind of football court on this. Just as a side note, if you're wondering how it was that Inter managed to stay out of the whole Calciopoli scandal in the first place, it probably bears mentioning that all the recordings were made by the Italian mobile phone giants, TIM, who are controlled by one of the majority shareholders in Inter. But that's a coincidence, of course. Sorry, John.
Why were these conversations being recorded? That's one thing I don't understand.
Well, because Gabriele Marcotti once told me, and I have no reason to believe this isn't true, that there are more phone taps in Italy than the rest of Europe put together. They operate massive amounts of phone tapping, the police do, for all sorts of inquiries, anti-drug things, anti-hooliganism measures are massively based on eavesdropping on people's conversations and trying to block any planned moves. And because there had been various accusations made against the people at Juventus, and there was a judge in Turin who really wanted to nail the Juve people, who he felt got away with it on the doping scandal which preceded. They were eventually found guilty of having a massive pharmaceutical warehouse inside the stadium, which they were doling out in liberal quantities to all their players. But because of the statue, what do you call it, the statue of limitations?
It's a statute, not an actual statue.
It's not a statue. I thought
no.
They don't go to
no.
All right, this statute, as you call it, of limitations. Anyway, because of that, they basically weren't able to hand them any, you know, give them any actual punishments. So he was hot for Juve, as I believe they say in the argot, and also because police down in Naples, where this trial is now going on, were making a whole load of phone taps as part of their anti-mafia operations, and were able to record various conversations relating to Moggi's activities and his attempts and successful attempts usually to influence people and get people to do him favours. Anyway, hey, posts. Sergei Russia posting in saying, will there be a special pod on a daily basis during the World Cup? In brackets, well, at least until England gets knocked out. Well, yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, there will be a World Cup daily or whatever it's going to be called.
It looks special in the needs sense.
No, it'll be terrific stuff with all sorts of South Africa-based correspondence and up-to-the-date information and that kind of thing. Very much your go-to guide, your companion, if you will, to the whole tournament there. And, James Wormel posting is saying, I think it's time the pod have a chat about the myth of Martin O'Neill, who he doesn't think is any good and basically gets away with it on account of the fact that he's a British manager. John, are you an O'Neill fan?
I would say probably an O'Neill fan. Yeah, he's built a reasonable squad based on English players and young players at that.
Have they not plateaued a bit?
Yeah, I mean that's the problem. But it's always going to be the case when you've got teams like Man City just throwing money willy nilly at things, and Villa to sort of reach the top sort of six and seven is still an achievement for them, I think.
Mm. It is. For me, I just think he's reacted from that 7-1 defeat at Chelsea just by having a bit of sulk. The whole aspect of his refusing to commit, I think that's perfectly that's how he acts, and it's just coincidentally timing. But it's the way it's all been brought in. I just think he's hasn't really reacted in with a huge amount of sort of maturity as much as I think he could have this week.
Okay, well, they have, of course, the FA Cup semis. They could be destined for cup glory. O'Neill's Villa. meantime, we've been keeping an eye on events at Yeovil, where Leeds are now 2-0 up. Richard Naylor with a brace.
Unbelievable, James.
Now, this is something we were talking about this morning because, of course, Leeds have been collapsing. They look like a cert for promotion. But ever since, indeed, probably even before the Millwall defeat, they've just been, you know, the wheels have been coming off, etc.
Yeah, well, our good friend Dr. Joe told me this morning that they've averaged 0.9 of a point per game in League One this season, or in 2010, compared to 2.4 points per game before the new year. But, I was talking to a Leeds fan, and he reckons that a lot of the problem might be down to the fact that apparently Simon Grayson, you'd think I would have said Larry if I was going to get it wrong, but apparently he's lost the dressing room over the manner in which he handled, if you remember when Leeds put United out of the cup, Beckford was scored. he wanted to leave the club, and Grayson decided to keep him, even though his contract is up during the summer and they won't get any money for him. And apparently the other players don't like Beckford. He's got, word is, and I don't know if it's true or not, word is he's got a bit too big for his boots. And as a result, the other players don't like him, and Grayson has lost the dressing room. But their form has been shocking. It's a spectacular choke because they looked at absolute certainties for automatic promotion before Christmas.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it has coincided with some teams at the top of League One having going on incredible runs. I think Norwich, until the defeat at the weekend, had just gone on an incredible run. Swindon, I mean, fantastic job they're doing. They've got Charlie Austin and Billy Painter up front playing fantastically well. Charlie Austin, a local lad, just come in, was playing at Poole, doing brilliantly now in League One. Young kid, keep an eye on him. And Millwall as well, they've done fantastic well. But if Leeds don't go up this season, it would be an amazing joke and one that Grayson would not survive.
Right. Okay. Newcastle.
You have to feel very sorry as well for Ken Bates. It would be a terrible tragedy to see.
Right. Yeah. Newcastle might be a Premier League team again by the time you hear this.
Very possibly, if they get a point against Sheffield United this evening.
And I think if Forest fail to beat Cardiff...
It could be before they even play then,
yeah. Yeah, they could be up without playing today.
Right. John, you got news from the conference.
Yeah, I was at... Well, it's not really news. I was at... Oh. It happened on Saturday. But I was at Stevenage against Luton, which is the top two in the conference, on Saturday. Stevenage went into the game having won 8 on the bounce. Luton went into it having won 7 on the bounce. And Luton maintained their run. And Stevenage, obviously, conversely, had theirs ended. Luton won 1-0 at the Lamex Stadium. Stevenage are still 2 points clear at the top of the conference and have a game in hand over second-placed Luton. And it'll be an interesting finale to the season down there. It's interesting because Stevenage are one of the very few non-league teams. So they've been in the conference for 16 years, and the conference this year is awash with former league clubs. I think Stevenage's average attendance is about 8th. It comes in just over 2,000, whereas Luton and Oxford, sort of the other big beasts, get closer to 7,000. So it would be a real achievement if the borough can get up. Although it's looking a bit dicey now.
Were you working?
I was working. Or? Yeah, I was doing a 700 word piece for the Observer, which ended up at about 350 once it got hacked to pieces. Man City's 6-1 hammering at Burnley cost me my slot in the paper.
Right. Okay, that's it for part two. Listeners, John did tell us a lot more about that game, but frankly, we haven't got time. Part three will feature an animated discussion about Liverpool and what Rafa's up to there and other, items of Premier League-related interest. As James Dart just pointed out, in part two, we went all the way from Barcelona to Stevenage. Part three is a similarly broad, arranging affair, which begins with Liverpool, who are fresh from a draw at St Andrews. Tough result this for them, and a big game coming up at home to Benfica in the Europa League. Torres being taken off controversially, with Steven Gerrard looking, as one commentator put it, like someone had just taken his Phil Collins record off. He stares as Torres walks past him being subbed off with the... What was the scoreline at that point? Was it 1-1, wasn't it?
It was 1-1.
Right. And, if you haven't seen it, Torres walks past him and Gerrard clearly asks him where he's going, and Torres just shrugs and says, I don't know what he's doing. And then Gerrard just turns and stares at presumably Rafa on the bench with this...
Was it a sort of the stink eye?
It's just like, what are you doing? And what he was doing was putting on David Ngog. Which, to no one's surprise, didn't work out. A variety of chances, James Dart, were missed.
Plenty of chances. Ultimately, Torres wasn't playing particularly well, so any manager has the right to take off any player who isn't playing very well and to replace them. I think because it's sort of an iconic figure in the game, and as a result, they still haven't been able to win the game, it pretty sort of comes back badly on Benitez in this respect. But I think what it does now, that point, I just think they're going to be 5 points with the game in hand for Manchester City and Tottenham and Aston Villa. I think there's too many teams and not enough games for them now to get back in whatever they do now, I think, personally. Even if they win every game, I still think that the likes of either Manchester City or Tottenham will get either 11 or 12 points from their remaining games.
Right.
The substitution suggests that Rafa's thinking exactly the same as you, Darty, that he's basically given up on the fourth place and he's concentrating on the Europa League.
Right. And how do you see their chances, John, of overturning that 2-1 deficit? Or was it 3-1?
2-1. 2-1 after two penalties, deficit. Wasn't it, in the first leg? Well, Benfica are a good side.
4 points clear, is it? Although they're playing tonight.
They play today, don't they? Yeah, in the Zagreb League.
Yeah.
Or Super League or whatever it's called. They've got a decent away record this season as well. They beat Marseille in the last round to go through. They drew against Hertha previously in Germany.
They beat Everton away, didn't they?
Beat Everton at Goodison.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if Benfica didn't go through.
I'd be surprised if Benfica didn't score, I think, and that could be the key issue.
All right. Liverpool have won their last 8 games at Anfield in all competitions, for what that's worth. But it would be a disaster. It would be the end of Liverpool's season this week if they don't manage to pull this one out of the bag.
Benfica were very, very impressive. And their ground appeared to be something of a bear pit. I don't know if they're going to get in trouble now for the firecrackers that were thrown, one of which landed very near the referee's assistant Europa League standing behind the goal dude. And like he leapt in the air, could have ruptured an eardrum or something, but or burst it. But yeah, so I'd look for a while that the game might actually be called off.
Mm.
I see the way you're actually gazing over my shoulder and nodding at producer Ben, and I suspect he's telling you that I'm boring the arse off everybody and to get me to shut up, so I will.
That's spooky. No, I didn't say anything of the sort. Nothing of the sort. But I will take the opportunity to move on. It is a whopping game on Thursday night. Of course, we will have a podcast before that on quite literally Thursday, but, you know. Anyway, also in action Thursday night, Wolfsburg are hosting Fulham. Fulham looked absolutely shagged out, and those were more or less Roy Hodgson's own words in that come-from-behind win against Wigan on Sunday afternoon. Whereas Wolfsburg, John, clocked up a 4-0 win over Hoffenheim in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, it was Fulham's 53rd game of the season against Wigan.
Yeah,
yesterday.
Not against Wigan, but, you know.
No, that would be slightly tedious after a while, wouldn't it? And it's their
that's actually like sort of one of Dante's circles of hell, having to watch Fulham play Wigan in an endless loop for all eternity.
And they've played 16 games in the Europa League. By way of comparison, I think Man United have played 48 games this season, so Fulham have played five more than them. And if you think about how leggy United looked at the weekend and how much bigger a squad they've got,
and the injuries as well that Fulham have been hit by at various times.
Yeah, they've been really, really stretched. It's been a phenomenal job that Roy Hodgson has done, and I really hope they go to Wolfsburg and get a result. I think they're one of the few teams that people don't dislike in the Premier League. You know, I think a lot of British fans would be quite keen to see them win the whole thing.
Was it 2-1 the first leg?
It's 2-1. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So Wolfsburg have the away goal.
They were unlucky to concede that goal. It was a very late goal at Wolfsburg, and a soft enough one too. They should be going to Germany with a 2-0 lead, which would be obviously a lot better.
You just wonder if they have enough sort of European nous to really sort of keep themselves and ensuring they get at least a draw. And it's tough now after that late away goal.
Yeah. All right, well, that's coming up on Thursday. In the meantime, also the weekend, all sorts of action in the battle at the bottom with West Ham. Barry, I know you were all over this game. The Everton-West Ham match with the Hammers getting a point after six consecutive defeats. But on the downside, Scott Parker banned for the next two games. What's that going to mean?
Well, he's their best player, obviously, and not having your best player in your team is obviously...
That's a bad thing.
It's not a good thing.
Right.
But it was a good game, actually. It started quite sluggishly and was quite literally a game of two halves. And the second half was a lot more tackles started flying in. There was a few dodgy decisions. West Ham had to come from behind twice, and their equaliser was a marvellous goal from Milan, a diving header.
Mm.
To get on the end of a marvellous cross over the top from Julian Fober, just to arrest that slide. You know, you could see they were delighted with the draw. Mido was awful. He's clearly overweight, and he's got a terrible haircut, and he takes terrible penalties. West Ham got a penalty. He took it, signposted which way he was going to put the ball, and took his sluggish run up, didn't get any power behind him, made it easy for Tim Howard to save.
Hmm. Well, there you go. But stopping the slide could be the most important thing about that result.
Definitely.
The two games that Scott Parker will miss, incidentally, home to Sunderland and then away to Liverpool. But, of course, they can also probably bank on Hull slipping up with their main rival and Burnley. And Hull and Burnley face each other at the KC Stadium next weekend. Interesting. Final games of the season, producer Ben notes, are West Ham at home to Man City and Hull at home to Liverpool, in which there's a kind of coming together of the race for fourth and the battle at the bottom. It's going to be a fascinating...
I suspect game. Liverpool could be out of the race for fourth at that
and
stage.
Hull could be out of the race for stage in the Premier League. Yeah.
It gives the potential of a Carlos Tevez goal relegating West Ham, which, of course, the opposite was true. A few years ago when Carlos Tevez goal saved West Ham.
So who could West Ham sue in that case then?
West Ham wouldn't be suing anyone. I don't know if Sheffield United could find somebody to sue. We'll probably have a go.
All right, excellent. Good news. In the meantime, that's it for today's special Bank Holiday Monday pod. We'll be back on Thursday. Thanks so much, Barry.
You're welcome.
And you, James Dart.
Not a problem, James.
And John Ashton too.
You're welcome.
As well as producer Ben. And you, the listener. We'll speak to you on Thursday. Have a lovely week in the meantime.
Football Weekly.
with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.